Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Craig Martin, a member of the club's Foreign International Relations Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest. Richard Lewis is one of Britain's foremost linguists. He speaks 11 languages: English, French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, German, Swedish, Danish, Norwegian, Finnish, and Japanese. After completing his schooling in Lancashire, England, Lewis went on to study modern languages at Nottingham University and also gained a diploma in cultures and civilizations from the Sorbonne in Paris. He founded the Berlitz Schools of Languages in Finland in 1955 and later opened schools in Norway and Portugal. In 1966, Lewis founded the Berlitz School in Tokyo and spent the next 5 years living and working in Japan, where he became the tutor to Empress Michiko. Since 1971, Lewis has been providing residential English language courses for foreign executives at Riversdown House, which is a 14th century medieval great hall on a 70-acre estate near Winchester, Hampshire, where he also lives with his family. His clients include SAP, Michelin, Iberia, Siemens, Rolls-Royce, and ABB. In addition to his career running language schools, Lewis is also well known for his work on cross-cultural understanding, which is why we're here today. He wrote the book When Cultures Collide, now in its third edition. It sold over 1 million copies in 12 different languages. And he gives cross-cultural seminars and keynote addresses to international corporations as well as governments in the United States, China, Europe, and elsewhere. His clients include UBS, Coca-Cola, Deloitte, Gazprom, Nokia, Unilever, and the World Bank. He has personally visited 135 countries and has lectured in 50 and worked in 15. He also is probably one of the few people present in the city who has actually spent 3 weeks in North Korea in 1979, where he led a table tennis championship team. You're a good table tennis player, I hear.
Lifetime.
Okay. In 1997, Mr. Lewis was awarded a knighthood in Finland in view of his 40 years' experience in helping Finland to develop its international links, including assisting Finland in its preparation for the EU presidency. He was promoted to knight commander in 2010. We are also joined by David Howells, global leadership coach and EMEA region head for Martin Global Leaders. He is based in London, and he is a former British Army officer. He won a scholarship to the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst and later worked for the UK Defence Ministry in Whitehall, London. With a background in psychology, Howells has worked as a senior executive coach for the past 18 years in a wide range of industries, both globally and in the UK. That includes banking, financial services, information technology, automotive, aviation, pharmaceuticals, and consumer products. He consults firms in the UK, Germany, France, Austria, Belgium, China, the Middle East, USA, and Canada, and he speaks some German and Mandarin. He is the leader for Martin Global Leaders in Europe, Middle East, and Africa, and he brings over 30 years of global executive coaching and broad real-world business experience to companies that aspire to have world-class leadership and have world-class business teams that are competing in the global economy. Richard's talk today is entitled When Cultures Collide. Of course, he will present his Lewis model, which provides a framework for understanding sources of conflict in religion, in business, in economic situations, and in other realms. These, of course, these collisions that Richard describes are, of course, very topical to Commonwealth Club programs, which recently have included topics on North Korea and Russia, Israel, ISIS, etc. So please join me in welcoming Richard Lewis to the Commonwealth Club.
I don't expect me to live up to that splendid introduction. However, I will do my best to tell you a few things that have happened in my life and see if it has any relevance to yours. It's a pleasure indeed, ladies and gentlemen, to address the Commonwealth Club. I had the opportunity to exchange a few words with most of you, some of you, and it's clear to me that I'm speaking to a very sophisticated audience, so I'll try not to be too elaborate. I'll explain things more or less as I see them. And I'd like to keep the tone fairly informal, rather than a lecture. I would think of it as, you know, a get-together. And we'll allow, what, half an hour or so at the end for any questions you have to ask, and I'll be only too happy to try to answer them. Okay, I'm using a few slides. I'll probably have to find the remote, which is probably very remote. Is it over there? Yeah. Thank you. I'm not very good with machines and technology, but I just about manage a microphone. When cultures collide, well, cultures do collide sometimes. I think we've all had, you know, cultural collisions when we've traveled. Cultures can also connect. And, you know, I'd hope to think that the British and American cultures connect occasionally. It's when cultures collide doesn't mean it's not a kind of negative thought, but if you are in business or if you are indeed entertaining people from abroad, and especially when you travel abroad, you will get into situations where you notice people don't act the same way that you do. I think one of the best, I say here, what is culture, well, the first thing I bring up, I think one of the best definitions of culture is an American one, which says this is the way we do things around here, and that implies that it touches on everything. It touches on business, negotiating, you know, presenting. There's a bit of culture in everything, and you don't always realize it. I worked a lot in Finland, as you heard, and a Finnish delegation came to me a couple of years ago and said we want to make a presentation on a certain topic. And so I gave them a couple of months instruction on how to present, thinking they were going to London, and in fact they went to London, and they said the presentation went down very well. Thank you, Mr. Lewis. And a couple of weeks later they phoned me up and said we gave the same presentation exactly in the same way in New York, and it fell completely flat. Why? See, well, you all know why, but you can't. An American audience does not expect the same thing as the British audience. We have such a thing as audience expectations. So, you know, what are your expectations today? What does one have to do to capture an American audience? It's very easy to capture a German audience because they come to learn. Germans live for information, either to give it or to collect it. What do Americans come for? Do they collect only information, or do they have other impressions? So we'll go through the various communication styles and listening habits. But let's start off with, you know, what is culture itself. It's because it touches on everything, it's very hard to define succinctly, and it's also very hard to draw. And I like drawing things, and this was my drawing of culture. And it's a kind of cloud, or it's a kind of atmosphere to which people are born into. So you're newborn and you enter that cloud, presumably in your own country with your parents from that country. And if you stay in that cloud, or atmosphere is a better word, for at least 12 years, and if you're American and you're born in San Francisco, you will, when you come out of that cloud, you will always be American in the way you live, the way you think. Psychologists tell us that 12 years is more or less the point where you don't change after that. And it doesn't matter if Europeans, they come to America, as many do, Italians, for instance, and if they come after the age of 12, it's very hard for them to become a real American. I know two Italian families who came to New York a few years ago. One had a boy of 3, and the other had a boy of 13. And after, you know, going to school for a few months, the little boy acted in a very American way, and all his life he was regarded as an American. This was 20 years ago. The other boy, at the age of 13, also went to American school, but he always seemed to be more Italian than American, or at least he was recognized as an Italian-American. Whereas the younger boy, after 6 months, was completely American. So, of course, age is very important in that respect. So what happens to you when you go into that cloud? Well, when you come out of it, you project that culture, American in this case, the diagram is for Germany. And it's very strong because culture, when you come out of the cloud or when you're living in the cloud, it's all around you. There are Americans all around you. But it's also inside you. It's internal. And that's why it's so strong. Now, culture cannot be passed on by one person. It takes 340 million Americans, or whatever the population is today, to pass the American culture to other people, because no one American knows the whole culture. It consists of many things, as you see, language itself, science, philosophy, food, dress. You can't pass it all on, but as a nation, collectively, you pass on the whole culture. And that is why, of course, it remains fairly constant over the years. Culture changes very slowly. Technology changes quickly. People say, oh, well, today, you know, everybody's going to be the same in a few years because of technology. What is happening is that the different countries like China and Russia and Brazil and the United States, they're all changing, but they're modernizing. They're not really changing their basic culture. They modernize at the same rate, maybe some a little faster than others, but they don't become different. The American will be an American, and the Chinese will be a Chinese over many years, and they don't really approximate to each other very much, although some people think they do. I don't want you to think I'm going to stereotype too much. We can say, you know, Japanese are ultra polite. You can believe that if you want. If you've been to Japan, you're likely to. But there's a danger in stereotyping. And one says very often, you know, a stereotype is not true. So then where is the truth? Well, the truth must lie somewhere else. Now, just think of how one can talk about people. If I say, and I want you to tell me, am I allowed to do this? I'm going to say, Italians talk a lot. Do you permit me to say that kind of thing? Say yes or no. Okay, Italians talk a lot. I'm not upsetting anybody, am I? If you've ever met an Italian, you know what I mean. And there are many in the United States. Now, can I say, number two, Italians talk more than Finns? If you know Finns, you know they don't talk at all. So it's not too difficult to swallow that one. Say yes or no. Italians talk more than Finns. Okay, if you've ever been to Finland, you'll agree. Finnish men, not Finnish women. Can I say Italians talk too much? No, why not? What's the difference about that one from the other two? Italians talk too much. You probably agree. If you're a Scandinavian, there's a Dane here. I'm sure he's agreeing internally that Italians talk too much. Where are you? Where's the Dane? Put your hand up. Do you agree? Italians talk too much. Well, what's the difference between the third statement and the first two? Yeah. The first two are kind of descriptive, but the third one is evaluative. It's judgmental. It's saying Italians talk too much. And you talk to an Italian, and they don't say, I talk too much. They say, you talk too little. You know. And if they're talking to a Finn, you say, you don't talk at all. So we shouldn't be judgmental, but you can say 13 things like Italians talk rather a lot and Japanese, you know, are very polite. And then you could make certain descriptions of Americans. On some of my seminars, I ask people, if you know someone who's leaving for Tokyo tomorrow and you know Japan, what advice you would give him? Very often it's stereotypical, you know, be very polite, don't cause anyone to lose face, and so on. And I try it with different nationalities. Germany. You're going to Germany tomorrow. Your friend is going to Germany tomorrow. What must you tell him? Two sentences. Well, you've got to come up with something. Turn up on time at meetings, yeah? Or be direct in your criticism. What would you say to someone who's going to America for the first time, young lady? What would you tell him? Give him some advice if you're going to America. Okay, smile. Is it going to be a genuine smile or a fixed smile? Because smiling is important culturally. If you've ever seen a Japanese, you know, Japanese smile at funerals, but they scowl at wedding pictures. And that's the way the culture is in Japan. So even a smile is a very cultural thing. There are many, the American smile is well known, but the Chinese smile is quite different. And some people like Finns don't smile. I keep talking about Finns because I work with them so much, but they're great people, of course. Well, let's look at something else. Let's say in different cultures, we have different habits. And even when we agree or disagree, there are different ways of doing that. So if a German says, if a German doesn't want to agree to something, he or she, what would he say? Germans are very honest people, frank people. So what does a German say if he doesn't agree? Believe it or not, he says, I don't agree. Right, right. Yeah, but what does an Englishman say? Because an Englishman doesn't like to say, I don't agree. Do we, David? You agree? You agree, do you? That, yeah. So, I mean, if I am asked, do you agree to this proposal at a business meeting by an honest German, you know, I don't like to say, no, I don't agree, it's a stupid idea. English people don't do that. What I would say is, interesting idea, Hans. And Hans thinks that I think it's interesting. That's the funny thing about it, you see. Hans thinks that I've said it's interesting. But this is the way English people talk, it's kind of coded speech. What would Americans say if you don't agree? Are you going to be like the German? What? Suggest something else. Well, it's pretty direct, yeah. Well, Americans are fairly direct people, as you know, but they're not as direct as the Germans. And Americans like to be a little humorous. So what would Americans probably say? Something like, you got to be kidding, you know. Which means I don't agree. But it's kind of, it's nice to say, you know. They heard it on the films before. You got to be kidding, you know. Put your foot down, lefty. Yeah, American English. What would a Chinese say? Ah, no. Ah, no. Well, remember, Chinese do not believe in absolute truth. There is no such thing as an absolute truth in China. That's Chinese philosophy from the beginning to the end. Well, they say something like... Which you're not quite sure what he means by that. You're not quite sure what he means by that. And the Indians, they came directly, but yes, you may be right, but, because Indians always have, you know, two opinions. What would a Swede say? Anyone? You know the Swedes, the Danish friend. You know the Swede. Exactly. The Swedes say, we must have a meeting, you know. And when they've had the meeting and they haven't decided anything, and you ask them what their opinion is, they said, we don't know because we have to have another meeting. See? So that's why Sweden has this reputation of being fairly indecisive. But anyway, they do good business, so we can't criticize them too much. What would an Italian say? You know, they're not very direct. Huh? Mamma mia. What? Right. We have a very original... A very original, yeah. Well, I hear them say. What would a Finn say? This is what a Finn says. What would a Japanese say? Because they're very indirect, as you know. The Japanese have a certain way of saying "I disagree." You know what they say? They say "I agree." Yeah. When a Japanese disagrees, he says, I agree. And all you have to know is whether he means I agree or I disagree, you see. But usually when they say I agree, they scratch their head like this, which means I disagree. And when you live in Japan a while. Okay, well, you know, it's very easy to misunderstand people when you don't know the culture of the country. And I can only give you a few hints this morning as to how that comes out in practice. The two big areas of misunderstanding are values and communication. And, so, of course... attitude to leadership. Values. Give me a typical American value. And give me a typical German value. Come on, they always say the same. Begins with P. Process. Yes, but you're supposed to say punctuality. You're supposed to say punctuality for German. Process is absolutely true. Now, punctuality was not invented in Mexico. So when Mexicans are working for German companies, you know, those difference of values, they cause problems. Give me a typical American value. Come on, some American. Independence. Yeah. Come on, another one. You must have some values. Open. Yeah. What else? Graphic. Oh, profit-minded. Bottom line orientation. Yeah. Of course. There are plenty of American values you could find. There are in every country. And, of course, they cause problems when you're working side by side with someone who has different values. I once worked for the German radio, or news announcer, and all the other news announcers came to translate the news, you know, at a certain time, French, Brazilian, Spanish, and it took them, you know, an hour and a half to translate the news, and then we read the news for 10 minutes. The Italian one, he didn't come an hour and a half before like we did. He came 20 minutes before, and the German editors were always thinking he wasn't going to show up, which is very serious in the radio business, for news anyway. And one morning, Giovanni came just 20 minutes before the broadcast, and it would, you know, but he was so good, he could always do it in time, but the German editor was besides himself with worry. His name was Herr Pfefferkorn. And when Giovanni came in, you know, at 20 past nine, he said, "Giovanni, wo bist du gewesen? Where have you been?" You know, and Giovanni said, "Oh, here I am." He said, "Du solltest hier um 9 Uhr gewesen sein. You should have been here at 9 o'clock." And Giovanni said, "Why, what happened?" The German said, "Nothing happened." He said, "Well, why should I have been here at 9 o'clock if nothing happened, you know?" And these two men lived in two different worlds, two different cultural worlds, you know. For the German, what was important, a priority, was you come to work on time. And for the Italian, it was nothing to do with that. His priority was that you come and give a good broadcast, even if you come last minute, you see. So they had two different standards. And the German, of course, he wanted a good broadcast too, but it had to be at 9 o'clock in the morning. He had to show up for work. And you can't reconcile those two things between Italians and Germans. Anyway, the other thing is communication. We communicate in very different ways, and we look at some communication styles in a few minutes and some listening habits in a few minutes. But you know, Americans communicate in a different manner from British, and Germans, again, Japanese. Can you imagine the differences? So, you know, some people speak with their hands, like I'm doing at the moment, but the English don't do much. You know, if you ask an Englishman how many people are there in Romania, he'll say, "I don't know." You ask a Frenchman how many people are there in Romania, he says, which means je ne sais pas, but, you know, the body language takes over. Some people speak quickly, some people speak slowly, some people speak in a loud voice, some people speak in a soft voice. Germans, for instance, when they get very angry, the leader of a delegation will speak in a soft voice. Most people think it's the opposite. Whereas an American or let's say, a French person will raise their voice when they get angry. So these cultural things, you know, you have to know. Okay, the other thing I want to talk about are layers of culture. And because we're talking about Americans, we're talking about Japanese and so on, and that's national. But, you know, what other layers of culture are there? Can you give me one or two? For instance, regional. I can't read this very, very small. Regional there. Oh, what other layers do we have? Men and women? Gender? Are they different? Of course they are. Yeah. What did Rex Harrison say? Why can't women be like men, you know? Men and women, they have different cultures. They do things in different ways. Regional, we were talking about, well, the same difference between someone from Boston and someone from Texas, someone from California and someone from New York. And then you have other professional. An engineer does not have the same culture as a salesman. So an Italian salesman and a German salesman might act in a very similar manner. But they would be, if you have two Germans and two Italians, the two who are liable to get on are the two engineers or the two salesmen, not just the two Germans and the two Italians. So professional culture is very important in the way you behave. Okay, and then you have, Yes. You have religion, which is very important in culture. You have, exactly, you have generational culture. My son is not like me, you know. My son is not like me. He'll never be like me. But he will be. In 25 years, he will be like you, you know. Okay, and then you have ethnic. You have Italian-Americans. You have German-Americans. You have British-Americans, and so on. And then you have the final thing, corporate culture. If you happen to work in California, corporate culture is very different from, you know, Texas. And we all know that if we work for IBM or if we work for Google or so on, there are always big differences. And then, of course, finally, it's the personal culture, is your combination of all those other things. So hands up those of you who think that the national culture is the strongest. You are what you are mainly because you're American. Hands up those of you who think the ethnic culture is the strongest. Yeah? Hands up those of you who think that your professional culture, whether you're an engineer or a teacher. Right? You see, there, you all of you have that in your makeup. In fact, all of you have all those things in your makeup. And that's why every human being is unique. And therefore, the personal culture is the one you live with. But it consists of many of the other things. Okay, we're talking about cultures. And, you know, how many countries are there in the world? Would you like to try that? More or less?
200.
Yeah, about 200 registered with the United Nations. Absolutely. How many cultures are there in the world? Next lady. She's not looking. How many cultures are there in the world? You needn't be too exact. Yeah. Well, are there more or fewer than countries? Far more, because in the United States you have many regional cultures. In Britain we have the British, the English, the Irish, the Scots and the Welsh. In France you have the North and the South. In Italy you have the North and the South. In Spain you have the Basques and the Catalans and the Andalusians and so on. So there are probably 300 very clear cultures besides just districts. Even in Denmark you have two big cultures, Jutland and Copenhagen. Okay, so it's difficult for us who are in the business, as David and Craig are, of training people about cultures. If you have someone from Google who's going to go all around the world traveling for his company or any big American company, it's hard to teach him 200 different ways of behaving. You don't have time to do that. So what you do is you try to train him, you know, in a category of culture. And so we divide cultures into three categories. And then we say, Germany is in the same category as the Netherlands, but Italy is in the same category as Spain. And so in our model, which is called the Lewis model, we talk about three types or categories of human beings. One is linear active, one is multi-active, and one is reactive. Now, you may start guessing what do those terms mean. Linear active, you know, what are linear active people like? Who are the linear active people? Well, these are the linear active people. These are the characteristics. You do one thing at a time. You go forward and, you know, you plan ahead. You're job-oriented. And all these characteristics there are typical of, well, whom? Maybe Americans, maybe Germans. And then you have the multi-active people who like to do many things at once. And they all like talking at once, doing different things at once. They're emotional. They talk a lot. Religion is important for them. It's a different category of person, far more emotional than the linear actives. And where do they live? You know, are they maybe Italians or Africans? Where do they live? And then you have the reactives. And they're the ones who react to other people's actions. So they're not very aggressive. They're accommodating. And they react. They're usually good listeners. They are usually rather quiet, don't talk too much. Where do they come from? And maybe you can see they're a Japanese or a Thai. Now, looking at those three columns, just think, which one do you personally belong to? Just give 30 seconds to look at that. What do you feel? All your personal qualities will not be in the same column. You'll be a combination of all three. But being Americans, very probably you're in one of those columns more than the other two. And if you happen to be Greek, you'll be maybe in another category. Okay, shall we try it? Hands up if you think you're principally linear active. We are in the United States, okay? Hands up if you think you're principally multi-active. Well, almost an equal number. This is San Francisco. And hands up if you think you're reactive. Yeah, I'd say there's a very good division there, a very multicultural audience, and that would be natural in a town like this and with an audience like this. That's very interesting. Now, you can guess that the linear active people, the Germans are probably, you know, the champions, but I'm going to show you a table in a moment, a league table, which is triangular, which shows you where people are. Now, how do we know? We have tested 76,000 people on the web, and we've given them questionnaires of about 150 questions, which they answer, and they come out as either linear active or multi-active or reactive or a combination. And the relative positions are the following. This is after 76,000 tests. Now, as you see in the bottom right-hand corner, the Germans are the champions of linear activity. Do one thing at a time, do it properly. Don't go on to B before you finished A, and so forth. And those other characteristics we talked about, job orientation and so forth, profits and so on, comes into it. And then, very close, the British and the Americans and the people in the bottom left-hand corner, Danes are there as well. And then if you look at the top, you've got the emotional people, the Italians, the South Americans, particularly the Greeks. And you've also got Africans and Arabs up in that area. And although the cultures may be quite different, the degree of multi-activity is the same. The basic characteristics are the same. Religion, emotion, strength of family, talkativeness, and so forth. And then in the bottom left-hand corner, I'm sorry. Yes. Where do you want me to start? At the top? Well, if I'm sorry. Can't you read that at the back? It's a pity. It's a pity because would you like to come forward, the ones of you who are further out? You can read it better if you get nearer. If you'd like to do that, I'll give you 30 seconds to do that. Okay? I mean, at the bottom, you know, you at the bottom left-hand side, the linear people are obviously the Germans, the Dutch, the Norwegians, the Northern Europeans, basically, and Americans of Northern European origin, and the Germanic races, Austria and so forth. At the top, you've got Italy, you've got Spain, you've got Portugal, you've got the Latin countries, but you've also got their Arabs and Africans are high up on emotion, strength of family, talkativeness and so forth. And the bottom left, bottom right-hand side, you have the Asians, Japanese and the Chinese and the Koreans and the Vietnamese particularly. They are accommodating, they are reactive, they react to your proposals. They're not aggressive. Of course, there are different levels of people, but nevertheless, in contrast with linear active people and multi-active people, they're accommodating, rather amiable, you could say. Tend to cooperate, so on. Now, these positions have been arrived at through testing, and some of them are quite surprising. So if you look at Scandinavia, for instance, you have Finland and Sweden on the bottom line, halfway between the Asians and the Europeans, because they're very good listeners and very quiet people, whereas your Denmark is on the other side, on the linear active side, but moving up towards multi-active, and that's because the Danes talk a lot more than the Swedes or the Finns or the Norwegians. And it's a pity you can't read this more clearly. It never occurred to me that the screens might not portray the whole thing. But you can ask me questions about any country at any time. Anybody want to know where they are? I mean, which country? You'll have to speak up because I can't hear you. Did you ask me something? What did you say? All right, let's move on. Yes. Yeah.
Japanese were very military, you know.
Yes, yes, yes.
Very military.
Absolutely. Japan, throughout their history.
Yeah, over the United States. You know, we had a sound, very quiet value system in their own past history. It had been very, very aggressive.
You're talking about the United States or Japan? Each of these countries. What do you mean by each of these countries? All of them?
No. In the case of Saudi Arabia, for instance, or Iran, or, you know, even, you know, China, North Korea, very aggressive.
Well, it all depends on the period of history. Period of history. But you do have characteristics which are lasting. For instance, if you compare the Japanese, who, apart from the period since the war, who have been very pacifist, and that's because of the atomic bomb was the traumatic experience they suffered. Japanese have been rather warlike through the history. Chinese, on the other hand, have been almost the opposite. You know, when you think of Chinese troops setting foot on Japanese soil, in spite of their huge differences. They scream and so forth at the Japanese, but they never go to Japan. Some people are more warlike than others, but a lot depends on the period of history. So, you know, people do change, but not much. And the fact of being aggressive or not depends on the historical circumstances, not only on the innate character of the people. Yeah, well, politics affect culture, but not very much. It's transient. You know, the Chinese people are very similar to what they were 2,000 years ago, and the Germans, you know, also have a long history, and the Indians have an even longer history, and they have characteristics. Politics affects people in a transitory manner, depending on what's just happened. Anyway, those are results of the tests. And it's interesting, if you happen to be of a particular country and you can't quite read this, is anyone from a country that'd like to know about where they are on this list? Yes? Yeah, what would North Korea is, well, you see, again, North Korea is not just Korea. Koreans have a certain place in this hierarchy, if you like, which is very close to Japan and China. They are the very strong Asian characteristics that we've talked about. North Korea is a complete exception because it's a dictatorship. Nobody has been free there for the last 50, 60 years. And you can't classify North Korea as a typical Asian country. Far from it. It's a dictatorship. It's like saying Germans are all Nazis. They're not. Germans are Germans, and they had a period where Nazism controlled their behavior, and that's what's happening today. Yes, of course. None of the other, you go slowly, none of the other nations, I'm sorry, let me hear you say it again. I didn't hear you. I'm not sure what point you're making. Every country has a culture, and Germans are different from British, and so forth. But you can't judge people on periods of political extremism, such as existed at the beginning of the war in Germany and in Japan. You can't judge those cultures on just that period. Germans have several hundred year history. Japan has 2,000 years history.
Richard, can I suggest that actually, if we have comments and questions,
yeah,
if you could put them on your cards,
yeah, put them on the cards.
We'll be answering those afterwards.
One has to be very careful talking about culture. Culture is a lasting thing. There are periods in a country's history which are not typical of its own culture. Okay, well, I'll have to go on because the next diagram shows that when we test you, you come out a combination of, you know, multi or reactive or linear, and you come inside that triangle, depending on how you've answered the question. So you see, that is actually a group of people from America, from the World Bank, in fact, and that is where they appeared in the triangle. Some of them were very linear active, some of them were rather multi-active. A lot of them were right in the middle, which pleased them very much because it showed that they were not extremists. It happened to be an HR department where mediation was important. But if we tested this group, you would come out in a similar pattern, perhaps. I tested a group in Denmark last week where most people came out in the bottom left-hand corner. It was because it was Siemens, and they were nearly all engineers. And engineers, being very linear and factual, come out in the bottom left-hand corner. So this is a different pattern for each group of people you test. And it helps a country or a company. It helps them to know where shall we send these people. So if you're going to send anyone to Japan, don't send the fellow in the top of the, or the lady in the top red section here, because they won't get on in Japan. Their views, their affinities, their policies are quite different. So someone who excels in Germany is likely to be a failure in China and so forth, depending on the type of business they're involved in. Yeah. Okay, so that's how we try to help companies. And you can judge, with this triangle, you can judge quite a lot of things. Like, for instance, truth is very scientific in the bottom left-hand corner. 2 plus 2 equals 4. That's scientific truth. But if you ask a French person, you know, how much is two and two, he's likely to say, c'est la départ, it depends, you know. Two horses, two cows, what does that make? You have areas where truth is situational. You have areas where it's contextual. You have areas, all these countries in the bottom left-hand corner would say, well, it's pretty factual. But, for instance, in the top of the triangle, truth is negotiable. You know, truth is negotiable. What do we mean by that? If you go to Italy, you'll see that truth can be negotiable. They don't tell lies. They just present the truth in a certain way which provides the best possible outcome. The Russians do the same thing. I'll give you an example. I have a friend called Alexander Kosov, who's from Russia. And one night in Moscow, we were invited to a party. And I went to this party at 8 o'clock as planned. And everybody was there except Alexander, who didn't show up. And then he came up at up the steps. There were about five floors without a lift. And he came up at 10 o'clock. Everybody said, oh, Alexander, you finally came. You know, what happened? He said, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, he said, on the way here, I had a puncture. And in Moscow, you know, in winter, you get a puncture. It's not like getting your car fixed in the United States in 20 minutes. You've quite an undertaking to get a puncture fixed in Moscow in winter at 9 o'clock at night. And so everybody understood and said, don't worry, have a drink, Alexander. And we carried on till midnight. And on the way home, I said to Alexander, Alexander, you don't have a car, do you? He said, no, no. I said, well, do your friends know that you don't have a car? He said, oh, yeah, they know I've not got a car. I said, then why did you give them the story about the puncture? He said, it's much better than saying, you know, I overslept. This is negotiated truth. He was late, but it was not exactly the truth, but it's more pleasant than the actual truth. Therefore, that's what Italians, when they're Italian banks, when they're making a monthly report to head office, like the Bank of Palermo, for instance, Bank of Sicily of Palermo, I have a friend there, and they have a meeting in the afternoon to write the minutes and send the report. But they have another meeting in the morning to practice what they're going to say in the meeting in the afternoon to make it more palatable and so forth. So they practice the meeting in the morning to write the minutes. Then in the afternoon they have the meeting again and they write the minutes. That is negotiated truth, see? And in Japan, truth is a dangerous concept. What do I mean by that? What do I mean by truth in not only in Japan, but in Korea as well, China as well? Truth is a dangerous concept. What do I mean? Yeah, exactly. So Mr. Tanaka is an engineer, and he's made a mistake in his calculation. And you're at the meeting, there's six or seven people along, and you say, Mr. Tanaka, you've made a mistake there. He has lost face irrevocably because he's an engineer, and engineers don't make mistakes in mathematics. You have ruined his career. You've caused him to lose face. Therefore, truth is a dangerous concept. Therefore, in Japan, and if any of you who live in Japan will know this, that you only use truth. You only say the truth if it is pleasant. If it's unpleasant, you just don't say it. And if you don't obey that rule, you will not be successful in Japan. So, as you see, there are different concepts of truth. And then we come to human mental programming. Now, you will see the bottom section there. There are one or two characteristics which are human characteristics, which we all have. And those are, you want to be liked, you are grateful for favors, and you love the young, and are angry at injustice. Hands up if you love young children. Well, hands up if you don't love young children. Okay, hands up if you want to be liked. Don't you want to be liked? Do you want to be liked? All right. Do you want to be liked? Do you want to be liked? You don't like to be liked. Yeah, well, that's okay. I accept that. But in 30 years of asking this question, only two or three people ever said, I don't want to be liked. One was a Frenchman, of course, in northern France. And he said, I don't want to be liked. And I questioned this a while. And finally he said, I don't care if anyone likes me or not. I said, what's your job? He said, company controller. So there are usually reasons why you don't have the universal characteristics. But the others in the middle there are all American. So the bottom are universal characteristics. All Chinese want to be liked. All Russians love their children. You know, all Japanese are angry at injustice and so forth. They're all universal characteristics. But then you get the national training. And the national training in America largely comes from the frontier spirit, which produced a lot of very positive things like individualism, self-confidence, future orientation, optimism. You know, the American pioneer, very positive. And that is the basis of the American character. But then if we look at some other countries like the UK, you have more conservative people who don't have the American characteristics of daring and risk-taking and so forth, but they have other characteristics, conservatism and so on, traditional characteristics. And we also have coded speech, which means that we don't say what we mean, and we don't mean what we say. So if this thing is very boring, it's, you know, very interesting, we say. Okay, and then you can do this with every country. You go to Germany and you see they are serious people. Remember, Germans are serious people who ask serious questions. And what do they expect? Serious answers. And with Americans and British, they don't get them, of course. And then you have Italians who are romantic and talk a lot. You have the French who like to be right. And they're very logical and they're very difficult to deal with if they disagree with you. And you have the Japanese who are very amiable and tend to agree, but you're never quite sure if they agree or not. And these are the different characteristics. And then you compare the French and the Americans. You look for what you have in common in the middle. So if you look, the Americans looking one way, the French person the other way, and you see the differences on each side. So formal, informal, first names in America, surnames in France. Formality and informality. Even haute cuisine in France, but fast food in America. So they're very different people. You see, there are not so many French Americans as there are Italian Americans or German Americans. So French people and Americans tend to be rather different. But there are some things in common. So in the middle, you've got the revolution, which is common to both countries. Liberté, égalité, fraternité sounds good to both. Sense of justice is similar. So when you're working with other people and other cultures, you try to find things which you have in common with them. And of course, it's fine when you can find that. And that's what we have to work with in business. And in fact, it works very well in either politics or economics as well. Find what you have in common with the other person and cultivate it. And then the communication patterns, again, are very important. If you look at the Italians, they talk a lot, 5,000 words to describe the proposition. Let's say it's a joint venture. And the Finn on the other side of the table who can't take 5,000 words. He asks the Italian, I'm sorry, I don't know what you mean exactly. Will you explain? So the Italian then explains in 10,000 words what he meant by the first 5,000, which is normal Italian. Italians use a lot of words. Whereas the Finn would have done the opposite. So Finland, you know, here he is, he says in 300 words what the Italian said in 5,000. And when the Italian, who doesn't listen for the first 300 words, says, I'm sorry, Pekka, can you explain? The Finnish male does not then use 10,000 words to explain, like the Italian did. A Finnish male uses 10,000 words in a lifetime. Finnish women talk a lot more. So there's a big difference in Finland between the communication patterns of men and women, which are not so different in the United States.
Richard, we have an audience that has 10,000 questions for you. We have to move on soon.
I'm afraid they'll have to wait another... A thousand demiseconds.
Okay.
I've got to finish the communication pattern. The USA, your cards on the table, this is your communication pattern. Very honest. It can be aggressive in argumentation, but usually make concessions later on. Germany, again, serious questions need serious answers. But they're pursuing, you know, die Wahrheit ist die Wahrheit, the truth is the truth. The most devious are the British, who, you know, start using coded speech when things are not going their way. What is coded speech? This is coded speech. Stupid suggestion. Interesting idea. You know, there was poor old Hans, the oddest German, and saying, oh, does that mean we can follow the idea? And we say to him, we'll have a meeting about your idea, Hans. Hans says, well, they're already in a meeting. Yes, but we will have a meeting about your idea. So then Hans says, well, then we can go ahead with it. And we look him in the eye and we say, Hans, we shall certainly consider it. Which means, in English, we won't do it. And so you have these examples of, you know, of coded speech. Here are some more. You know, if an English chairman comes into the room and says, correct me if I'm wrong, are you going to correct him? Because what he means is, don't correct me because I'm right. And then you have, you know, listening habits. And I've got to do two of these, even though we're running short of time. How do you make Americans listen? Well, you have to entertain them right at the beginning. And Germans don't know that, because Germans start giving them information. So a few years ago, I brought 19 Bavarian engineers to America, to Atlantic City, and they were missile engineers, and the Americans were the same thing. And a young American who was hosting the conference did the right thing. He made a joke at the beginning, and this was his joke. He welcomed them all, and he said, my friends, I'm sorry to have had to invite you to Mexico City, Atlantic City. But as you probably know, Atlantic City is a very boring place. He said, in fact, last Wednesday night when the tide went out, it didn't come back on Thursday morning. Well, you may think that's funny, but the German engineers, 19 German engineers, turned their heads and looked at me. And I knew what was going to happen. In the next coffee break, the chief engineer came over and he said, Herr Levis, why did the man say that the tide did not come back on Thursday morning? In Germany, the tide always comes back. And I said, it does also in the United States. And he said, then why did he say that the tide did not come back? I said, American humor. Ah, he said, American humor. He went back to his group and he said, it was American humor. And then everybody was happy with that. So you see, different listening habits. I'll have to stop here and let you ask questions. But if you see these different listening habits, Russians are suspicious, French won't agree with you, whatever you say, you know, there are the Russians. Finns, very simple listening habit. You give them a cup of coffee to start, and then they will listen 1 hour without interrupting. And then you have to give them another cup of coffee for another hour. And at the end of it, they give you no feedback. Okay. I'll have to stop there. There were many other things I could tell you, but leadership styles, you know, things like that. But I'll be rough. Yeah. But now, I'll just show you one more thing, and then I'll be open to questions. It's a pity you're missing all this, because I came a long way to tell you this, but I should have had a bit more time. If we look at two basic concepts like time, you know, we've both already mentioned that there are different concepts of time, but there are different concepts of space. So, for instance, how near can you stand to someone when you're talking to them? If I stood, you know, 6 inches from that gentleman, he would probably feel rather uncomfortable. Whereas the Mexican would not feel uncomfortable, because Mexicans like closeness. And this is a bus queue in Portugal, where they're all standing close together, and everybody's comfortable, because it's a Latin country. But this is another bus queue in Finland, where they're, you know, where's the bus stop? I took this to Brazil, and the Brazilian said, where's the bus stop? I said, it's there. Why is the woman not standing next to the bus stop if she's first? Well, Finns don't do that. Well, why not? Because, you know, they don't like to boast. And so the Brazilians looked at this picture and said, that is not possible in a bus queue in Brazil. And if you take a picture of a bus queue, everybody waves and smiles. People in the bus queue talk to each other. This is not a bus queue. But we know one thing about these people. They're very honest people. I said, yes, they are, but how do you know? They said, well, if you leave that black bag there, you see, that was what the Brazilians saw in the picture, a black bag which had not been removed. So that's how they didn't think of it as a bus stop. Okay, I'll stop there, but even time and space are very different. Okay.
Thank you, Richard.
That's a picture of another bus queue. I was proving to them that Finns really do queue like that. They didn't believe me. They said, in this picture, you've fixed everybody. I said, no, I've not fixed everybody. Look at this bus queue. There we are. So if you go to Finland, you queue up like that.
Richard, these diagrams are also in your book, are they not? Okay. So there are copies of When Cultures Collide, which are in the back, and you can have plenty of time to study these different diagrams, which are fascinating. Richard's done an amazing job of identifying how different cultures communicate and negotiate and that sort of thing. Let me actually trade places with you for a moment, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, I'll use this mic when you
sure. All right. So I have to perform a little housekeeping here, the official script. So our thanks to Richard Lewis, author of When Cultures Collide, for his comments here today. I'm Craig Martin, a member of the club's International Relations Forum, and I will be moderating today's audience question period. Richard, we have a large number of questions.
Oh, dear.
So let's begin.
Oh, dear.
This is a great question. What's the most difficult cultural interaction you have ever encountered?
Well, the differences in culture are the reason. And normally speaking, you would say that the further a culture is removed from your own culture, the more difficult they encounter. So, for instance, Italians and Spaniards get on very well together because they're in the multi-active category. But Koreans and Spaniards don't get on well together, or they don't understand each other very well. But Koreans and Japanese, being in the same category, although they don't necessarily like each other all the time, they understand each other. So it depends on the distance between the culture and your own.
How about for you, personally?
I found it hardest to understand the Japanese among all the other countries for that reason. But having lived in Japan about 3 months, you learn, you get used to it.
Yeah.
But so, it does depend. You know, Americans understand Canadians very well. They understand Mexicans a bit less, and they probably don't understand Bulgarians very well at all.
Another question is, over the years of cultural communication, have you ever had to discard, redefine, or change any of your communication tactics or theories? And if so, why?
We've noticed one or two slight changes in some cultures. I mentioned earlier the traumatic effect of the atom bomb on Japan. It did change their culture up to now. They're drifting back towards militarism, but the Japanese culture and the German culture changed. East Germany became a new culture in a sense because of the being behind the wrong side of the Iron Curtain. But in general, you know, cultures don't change very much. We have noticed that during our testing period over the last 20 years, the Dutch people, the Netherlands people, have become more multi-active than they were. Yeah. But otherwise, not much has changed.
This is another question related to the model itself, and that is, did the 76,000 questionnaires ask people to describe themselves and or their culture's traits, or did you draw those conclusions based on questions and responses that reflected those traits?
I'm not sure what the question is, but... I'm afraid you'll have to rephrase that.
Were you asking people to define their cultures in your surveys? Or was it...
No, we were asking them, how do you feel about these things? For instance, we may ask a question, you're starting an important meeting and the chairman does not arrive. Do you start or do you wait for the chairman to come, and how long do you wait? So, for instance, you know, in America they'd say, well, look, you just start. In Canada we'll say, you wait 3 minutes. The Chinese would say, you have to wait till the chairman comes.
Yeah.
So that type of question.
So you presented scenarios that people responded to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. How do your ideas translate to the conflict between Islam and the West?
Well, religions go through different periods. The most successful culture in Europe from the year 650 AD to 1492 was undoubtedly the Islamic culture based in southern Spain. Cordoba was the biggest city in the world at that time, in the year 1000. And it was a very successful culture where there were various strata, and the top strata was in fact Jewish, the second strata was Arabic, and the third was Christian. And they all got on very well together. Today, since September 11 and other things that have happened, the Islam is going through a difficult period in its relationship with the West. But it's all transient. It can change dramatically in a few years. Certain events can take place. You had the Crusades, which were another period, exceptional period. So religions, they're not fixed. They're fixed in a way, but their relations with each other are not fixed. And that was the best period of all human civilization as we know it, was 680 to 1482 in southern Spain, when the Moors were in charge.
Here's another question that's related to your model, and this is relevant to Americans, where we have different ethnicities in terms of immigration. So, how do second generation ethnic Americans fall in the Lewis model? Do they fall in the middle of the triangle necessarily?
Well, you see, people very often say that America does not have its own culture because it's a mixture of all the cultures. And that's wrong, because America does have, the United States has a mainstream culture. And if you think about it, you know, what is the American mainstream culture? First of all, if you have a job, you have to turn up on time. You have to be reasonably well-dressed. You have to be clean. You have to work hard. You don't take a long holiday in a crisis. You have to be bottom-line oriented. You know, you have to be enthusiastic. This is the American mainstream culture. It's a very good one, but it's a business-oriented culture. As you hear very often, the business of America is business. So America has a mainstream culture, and the other subcultures exist, but they don't exert enormous influence on national policy. There is such a thing as an American mainstream culture, which a lot of people can't quite figure out.
Thank you. We have time for just one more question. So how should a senior executive thinking about taking on a new role in China, what should they be doing or thinking?
Well, if you go to China and you plan to do business there and working for an American company with American principles that you're familiar with, you have to reshape your thinking. The basic reason is that America is a very individualistic culture. American culture is very individualistic. And the Chinese are just the opposite. They're very collective. So everything has to be addressed to a group. You can't single out, even for praise, you can't single out individual Chinese. If you've done a good job, you have to address it to the group. So that's the big difference between collective cultures, of which, you know, there are a lot of, all of the reactive cultures and many of the multi-active cultures are collective. And the linear active cultures tend to be individualistic, particularly the United States, Australia, and to some extent Britain. So you've got to, if you go to China, you've got to think in terms of group and collective behavior, not individual action or individual decisions. Excuse me, I'm getting a bit hoarse. Yeah, anymore?
Thank you. So our thanks to Richard Lewis, author of When Cultures Collide, for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 112th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.